everybody, Marcus here. Now I want to remind everybody of our pact that for every 1,000 subscribers I receive on this channel, I will give away one copy of CyberLink's PowerDirector 13 Ultra software. So please consider liking this video, sharing it, subscribing, or even just listening to the very end. The venerable distinction of the alpha-beta-male dichotomy present in discourse on male-female relations is something that I feel has been very poorly covered in all contemporary commentary. The approaches I've seen covered so far come across as grossly reductionist and superficial. It is said that the alpha male is at core a genetic lottery winner, you know, someone who through the virtue of innate biological traits is simply better genetic stock than the beta male. He is imagined as tall, disposed to a slim and muscular physique, symmetrical, aggressive, and dominant. Now, the validity of the traits listed here can easily be verified by attempting to describe a man who is the opposite, short, you know, pudgy or fat, displaying asymmetry, deferent, and submissive. But even amongst this group of alpha males, we still cannot seem to consistently observe every quality we have offered so far. So a short man, such as Napoleon, could hardly be considered a beta. Fat men, too, can be observed exhibiting alpha behavior, as can asymmetrical men. As to aggression and dominance, these seem to be more in line as core elements when describing such a man. It is, however, at this point that I believe that the account typically takes a reductionist approach. Links to elevated levels of testosterone are made, which then are used to also account for the more masculine appearance, you know, less neotenous appearances of these men. You know, hair growth, muscle growth, and any other number of features that we associate with overt masculinity are brought under this biological account. This account, however, gives us absolutely no insight into the existential experience of such a man, nor does it give us any pragmatic insights. I mean, insights that might help us answer questions like, is being an alpha male a desirable experience? Is such a man happy? What is the price of being such a man? And most importantly, can a beta become an alpha, and alpha become a beta, and what would that transition look like? To answer these questions, we need an altogether different account. So let's see if we can put together such an account. Perhaps the best way to start is to first construct the conditions under which such a being is even possible. Firstly, the idea of an alpha presupposes competition. Competition demands an opponent, and also presupposes a winner and a loser. For how could we ever tell if one man was alpha and another beta, unless those two were pitted against each other? Well, we could not. But let us consider this winning and losing phenomenon. Would it be imaginable that an alpha male always lost and would be still considered alpha? I mean, surely not. What about a man who lost half the time and won half the time? Well, would he be alpha? Well, surely not as well, since then his opponent would have equally lost and won in the same ratio, and then the alpha-beta division would again become meaningless. No, the alpha would then necessarily need to win more than he lost. Now, let us consider what comes with winning and what comes with losing. When we win, we are praised, and from this praise we gain a sense of elation, you know, a euphoria of sorts. When we lose, we are not only deprived of this euphoria, but feel shame. Either shame from, you know, being pitied or shame from being condemned. Now, an alpha, as we have said, will win more than he loses. This would mean that he more often experiences this euphoria and less frequently experiences shame. He is not made to suffer as often. But the man who suffers will develop ways of dealing with that suffering. He will become hardened to it, resistant. His constitution will mend like a broken bone, denser. The beta's ability to withstand suffering will be far greater than that of the alpha. But what happens to the alpha? Would not the opposite effect happen in him? Would he not grow hardened and resistant to the euphoria of winning? Would it not progressively demand greater victories to satiate him? Well, surely it would. You see, to the degree that a man exclusively wins, does he lose his ability to handle defeat and therefore endure shame? To the same degree, do ever grander victories become necessary? But from time to time, such a man will still lose occasionally, And when he does, the torrent of suffering he experiences is unintelligible to him. He is thrown into a sense of confusion as to what is happening. He can only make it intelligible as a great injustice done to him. And when he senses injustice, he will be thrown into a rage, you know, demanding retribution. Often he will lash out at the opponent he failed to defeat. But what happens if he would lose twice in a row? This time his rage is tempered by fear. For one defeat he could account for as an injustice. But for two in a row, I mean, he fears a loss of his power. And now we see that no longer driven by the euphoria of victory, as it has become a sense of normalcy, now he is compelled by the fear of defeat, for it is intolerable suffering to him. But eventually he will get old and fresh blood will begin to overtake him. With this realization and the fear of the terrible burden of defeat, he stops playing. He quits. By removing himself from the competition, he retains his glory of past victories without the fear of any future losses. But between his early years and the years that lead up to his retirement, many things must surely transpire within his soul. The earlier years of his life were fairly normalized with those around him. You know, in most likelihood, his peers were of similar economic status, of similar family background, and in most ways, led a life not unlike his own. These are the conditions of primary and secondary schools, as well as university. You know, little distinguishes the conditions surrounding one 8-year-old from another in the same school. But in these conditions, this man sees himself overcoming where others do not. He thinks to himself in the secret places of his soul, "As all things are equal between me and them, why do I win while they lose? Well, surely it must be that I am better." And in this thought, he has established an order of rank between himself and all other men. But there's no nuance in this ordering. It is a winner and loser hard divide, for there's no gradient to victory in this environment. You either win the game or you lose the game. You either get elected for valedictorian or you do not. You are either prom king or you are not. You either get the girl or you do not. You are either popular or you are not. But what is he to make of those who achieve what he achieves? Well, a new order of rank begins to form for this group. However, this order of rank is slightly different. For you see, this perpetual winner may find himself at the bottom of the top. And this cannot be accounted for by the simple winner-loser dichotomy. You see, he is a winner, but he is at the bottom of the top ranks of winners, so he must also be a loser. This would be a contradiction to him. In order to resolve this contradiction, he must divide the world. Those of the top ranks must all be winners, and those below this rank are all losers. You know, the common people of a seemingly different class. Since those at a similar station of his are of a different kind, a different class of people, different rules must apply to them. An aristocracy forms. But the account we have given of the alpha male is still incomplete. After all, this aristocracy, under this account, would allow for people such as the high school chess captain, or the winners of the math league, the first chair flute players as well. I mean, these sorts of people are not who we imagine when we picture the alpha male. No, we envisage the football quarterback, the business executive, you know, the captain of the soccer team. But why do we picture these people, even though the competitive spirit, you know, the perpetual winner and the dominant person would be a chess grandmaster? Well, we must now account for the object, the competitive spirit that a man turns towards. Let us account for three types of winners: the football star, the corporate executive, and the academic. The academic is dominant and aggressive in a very narrow sliver of life. His dominance is contingent on the nature of the competition being in his field of study. His influence upon the world is very narrow when compared to the executive and football player, and also the subject matter of the academic is by far the most abstract, requiring a certain fierceness in intelligence and memory. Now, let me clarify what I mean when I say that the academic has the least influence. This may seem counterintuitive if we imagine people like Nikola Tesla, I mean, who has influenced the life of pretty much every human to ever follow. Though this is true in the abstract, it is false in the immediate life of Tesla. The work of his genius had no benefit to him in his life, And this is true for most academics. Their genius is exploited later by industry and benefits the executive and not the academic. The executive, on the other hand, has a much wider reach in his influence through the ability to command money. He has the ability to make many things happen, but they must be planned in advance. The executive work is also less abstract than that of the academic. He is more grounded and pragmatic than the academic. And finally, the football player. This man has an influence everywhere he goes. You see, I'm not necessarily referring to the money and celebrity that a football star holds, but I'm merely referring to his raw physical stature. No matter where he is and what he is doing, he is always in the strongest position to both beat down the executive and the academic. You know, imagine these three men in a room. If a conflict escalates to the, you know, extreme termination point, which is violence, then the academic is in the weakest position. No amount of abstract thinking will prevent him from getting killed. In this way, too, no amount of money in that moment of time will prevent the executive from getting killed, but an attempt at bribery is available to him. But the raw physical strength would help the football player to dominate the others. The executive, however, could attempt to bribe the football player to leave him alone or bribe the academic to team up on the football player. But money is an intermediary power. It works as a proxy and itself is not something that exerts itself upon the world. But in this way too, the football player is even more grounded in his power. There's no abstraction to brute physical strength like there is in money, and further still, to academic abstraction. From a human development perspective, the football player came first. Then we invented money and we got the executive. And finally, when enough prosperity is around, the academic can emerge. But clearly, the football player was the dominant creature for a very long time in human history. Those same traits present in a man that are present in the football player were those that dominated. Those traits, in this way too, were also the most grounded, you know, the least abstract. It is also how the human mind evolved from base instinct to higher reasoning. But sexual attraction and mate selection long preceded higher reasoning. And in this way too, those bodily, animalistic, bestial, you know, superficial, obvious qualities became what one could select from. So sexual attraction in this way too must have chosen only from those qualities that had existed at the time, which were all physical and superficial for both men and women. We had no language skill back then, so the sense of humor women so looked for was not really something that existed. But what must have existed was laughter. But then laughter, too, would have been triggered by what I can imagine being a slapstick comedy that played itself out in day-to-day life. And so perhaps one day a man learned to mimic those things which he saw got women laughing, and so became literally a dancing monkey. But here, too, humor is a bodily thing. The ever-present theme is that sexuality was anchored in the base and not in the abstract. And now we can start to get an impression of how this aristocracy of alpha males comes to be filled with those who dominate in the most base ways possible, and how the executive and academic, with an ever-growing level of abstraction as to the domain of their dominance, loses out to the base qualities of the football player. You see, we have an order of rank where dominance is concerned. The male that is dominant in the base, in the physical, is first because he is the longest and deepest ingrained standard of sexual attraction. He is the man who would previously be on top of everything. But now that society is not governed through the application of physical violence but by money, the executive becomes a dominant figure. But even so, the woman would still rather fuck the football player because in the deepest parts of her soul, she knows that the football player could kick the executive's ass and she would be physically safer with the football player. Then trailing in distant third is the academic, the man who dominates in the highest realms of abstraction. Though his type of domination can be the very fabric of thought itself, you know, like Socrates, and though he is a type of man that forwards humanity as a whole, he is the least desirable of all the three because he is furthest from the base and raw physicality. Now, one caveat we need to throw into this account before we proceed. I want to make clear that I am not saying that football players are stupid, nor saying that academics are physically weak. What I am saying is that it will not be the intelligence of the football player that generates the attraction, And in this way, it will not be the intelligence of the academic that will sexually attract a woman. If you happen to be intelligent, then that's all well and good, but it won't get you laid. In the same way, the executive might be able to attract a hot woman, but she still would prefer to fuck the football player. But she may sacrifice some of that sexual attraction for the overwhelming benefits that money provides in modern society. So now I think we have identified the alpha male we have been searching for. It is not the executive and it is not the academic. It is the football player. So let us go back in our story and revisit the aristocracy that has formed earlier in our argument. First, we must assert that different aristocracies can form, each filled with men dominant in a certain area. There will be those dominated by athletes and celebrities. These are individuals who dominate due to their physical natures, you know, the sensuality of their being. The dominance of the athletes and celebrities is not grounded in their money nor in their intelligence. Though money often follows from this dominance, it is not the cause of it. It is their sheer physicality. Though some male celebrities are on the physically less attractive side, you know, they often compensate through humor, and so are in comedy mostly. Which is still a base phenomenon pandering to the physical effects it has upon the body. I mean, these comedians, however, fit better into the second type of aristocracy, that of the executive, or people of money in general. I mean, these men are quite desirable due to the power they can exert upon the world through the proxy of money. Their dominance is grounded in the money they possess, and not in their physical quality, nor their intelligence. The third type of aristocracy would be that of the intellectual elite. Their dominance is grounded in pure intellectual matter. Their sexual attraction, however, is of the lowest kind. Now, each aristocracy that forms will value their particular form of dominance as the highest, though they may acknowledge some secondary and tertiary value of the other two. Now, of these three aristocracies, which will win favor with women the most? Well, if everything we have said so far holds true, we will have to say the first type, the aristocracy of physical dominance. We can see this order of rank play out in high school as a microcosm. I mean, the football player and the hottest women will be the coolest crowd. The rich kids may be useful and therefore still dateable, and so will come second in social ranking. And finally, we have the nerds. To the football players, everyone outside of their aristocracy is a loser, and so is the case with the other two. However, the aristocracy that the hottest women align themselves with has become the socially dominant group. And in this way, the alpha male is not the alpha male because he is physically dominant, but because women choose physical dominance over all the other forms of dominance. You see, what made these men gravitate to their respective group is independent of women. Inner drives, compulsions, and interests dictated their path. But women are primarily attracted to one specific group. And since women were primarily attracted to the football player, then the alpha male label was bestowed upon the football player. Had women been attracted primarily to intelligence, then the alpha males would be the nerds. This is why we see alpha males being natural with women. These alpha males are natural in both senses of the word. Firstly, they are natural in the sense that it seems reflexive how they know how to interact with women. You know, like they always know what to say at the right time and so on. The second way in which they are natural is in the sense that they are the most base. They are furthest from abstraction and closest to the animal nature of man. They are hedonistic by nature. They are very in tune with the superficial aspects of existence, of the sensual, of the rules governing pleasure and pain. And do we not in MGTOW continually say how base and superficial women are? How important the physical is to them? Well, like attracts like. Both these men and women are in tune with the superficial. They understand it slightly differently, but they in essence are compelled by the same things. So you get rampant drinking, drugs, parties, you know, and all those other sensual experiences that constitute the normative nature of their social interactions. The alpha male, it would then follow, is a hedonist in his soul. He is the least nuanced of all men, the most basic and animalistic. But this also makes him the most susceptible to manipulation. You see, as we have said earlier, this man has won much more than he has lost, and as such has a tolerance for the euphoria of victory, but a deficiency in handling loss. So in this way, a woman can more easily exploit his sense of shame to her own ends. Now, before we can continue with this argument, we must immediately address the notion that a man with many options is not desperate, and therefore can make wiser choices. Also, we must address the notion that a man with little choice becomes desperate, and therefore makes poorer choices. These phenomena seem to stand in stark contradiction to what I'm arguing, so let's just tackle them right here. In what follows, I will argue that both of these men tend to make equally poor choices. First, let us tackle the football player. His alpha male status presents to him many women to choose from. Now, what is not in question here is the volume of options. What is in question is the wisdom behind choosing a woman as opposed to choosing no woman. You see, for a man of this level of desirability, the wisest choice is not to choose at all, but to exercise the virtue of moderation. By selecting any particular woman to marry, he is in essence discarding the benefits of being an alpha male. He reduces himself to the same level as someone who has access to only one woman. But in doing so, he puts himself in a very peculiar position. Earlier, we concluded that this man is a hedonist at heart. So it must follow that by choosing to be with only one woman, he surely thought to himself that this choice must be more pleasurable than a revolving door of women. Now, what would compel a man to choose to commit to marriage vows when he has access to many women? Well, some pleasure he could not get from volume. Love. At the peak of his reign, he marries out of love, but more specifically, out of eros, erotic love. You know, that madness that strikes him. You see, having been presented with so many options, he is burnt out on sex alone. He has grown dulled to mere physical beauty. You know, these things no longer evoke in him the sort of desire that these women would evoke in a beta male. They all start to look the same. So how can any woman distinguish herself? Well, she can't. Not unless he is struck by eros. Now, eros is not rational nor a choice, though his commitment to this woman is a choice. However, his marriage does not indicate that other women will not show interest in him. Oh no. Year in and year out, he is still shown favor. At first, it is easy to feel confident in his decision, but as eros wears off and the monotony of the same woman begins to wane on him, he begins to doubt his decision. He begins to long for those, for any of these other women who continually show interest. His wife may begin to sense this hesitation and succumb to jealousy and act accordingly. Her best tool is shame. He is made to believe that he is to blame for the interest of these women. She manipulates in order to keep him in check. Now, he finds himself in a trap. He is trapped through fear and shame on a few fronts. The shame that is thrown at him from accusations of infidelity, the shame of thinking himself capable of this infidelity, and the social stigma that would come of it, and the ever-growing fear that he is missing out. His wife grows older, but the women who show interest are still young. He grows to resent his wife, but also feels loyalty to her. He is perpetually in conflict with himself. He either has an affair and succumbs to whatever consequences that entails, or he suffers the pangs of unfulfilled desires. He was never meant to be with one woman, but now he cannot act on his nature. He suffers. But there is another path that this man may take. You see, he may not marry out of love. He may weather the storm of various stings of eros for many years and indeed lead the life more suited to his nature. But then eventually his run will come to an end. Where at first 9 out of 10 women would approve of his advances, soon it dwindled to 8, and then 7, and so on. He reaches a point that we have described before. He begins to realize he is losing, and this throws him into great fear. This realization that he is losing his access to women compels him to quit. So he marries. However, this too was not of his choice. He wished to remain desirable. For this man as well, he will not be satisfied because his nature is not that of someone meant for one woman. This man too will succumb to the same outcome as the alpha male that married out of love. You see, alpha males also choose for poor reasons. The very act of choosing one woman is a poor choice for them, as it is in direct contradiction to their hedonistic nature. And where the first one chose love, chose to gain pleasure. The one who married out of fear and shame chose to avoid pain. No, the correct choice would have been to stay single. But then in that too, their nature chose for them and as such had no real option to begin with. But then what of the desperate man with few options? Well, his choices are slightly different. He has the option not to choose at all or to choose from the first woman who would have him. His own personal hell, however, is of a different nature. You see, a man with no options is not the same as a desperate man. A man may have no options presented to him, but neither does he concern himself with the specific game. For example, I have no offers to play in any professional, amateur, or even hobby football teams. This, however, has caused me to lose no sleep. Now, in order to be desperate, one needs to desire to play but have no option at the same time. The desperate man, however, should first choose prostitutes, which are available to him. However, it is clear that this sort of man is not desperate merely for sex, but for the approval of a woman who would choose him. Now, we must juxtapose this man to the alpha male on the paradigm of winning and losing that we have talked about before. You see, the desperate man has lost a great deal. He has grown very tolerant to shame, and as such, his resilience to it allows him to select a woman who an alpha male would never consider. It is not his weakness, but his ability to suffer that allows him to settle, as it were. However, like I have mentioned in many previous videos, it is the golden mean we need to shoot for. No, this man has too much resilience to suffering, whereas the alpha male does not have enough. This man is willing to suffer that which impinges on his basic human dignity, and in this, his strength to endure suffering becomes vice. If, however, he finds a woman, his ego will be greatly boosted. He will in one swoop become arrogant, possessive, and jealous. His own personal hell will not come from the woman, but from these additional qualities that having a woman adds. You see, he is very capable of suffering a woman. He is used to suffering rejection and has grown dulled against it. Now, the suffering that he adds to his life will not come from her, but it will come from his jealousy and possessiveness. These are new sufferings that he is not used to. The world for him will overnight transform into a much worse place, as now every man becomes a threat. For him, every woman is a bad choice. In fact, the more perfect she is, the worse his suffering will become. So here too, we see that, like the alpha male, the desperate man should not choose any woman at all. In this way, both of these types of men, in fact, have only one valid option available to them: not to choose a woman at all. Now that we have addressed the concern of the desperate man making poor choices while the alpha making wise choices, let us go back to where we left off and talk about the alpha male and his connection to shame. So, we have said several times now that the alpha male is not used to losing. As such, he is not resilient to shame, and he has had little opportunity to deal with it. But in this way, too, he is not accustomed to suffering in general, except perhaps maybe in the physical kind. But, as Nietzsche says, suffering is of the most importance to personal growth, for it is only when we suffer do we become an interesting being. When we suffer, we are forced to reflect upon ourselves, you know, our choices, and are forced to exercise our creativity in order to avoid future sufferings. It is how we learn, for if we want to drill a harsh lesson into someone, it needs to be accompanied by pain. Memory retains the lessons of pain, not so much of pleasure. So in this way too, our alpha male is not going to be an interesting being. The world is not something that requires a great deal of questioning, as it seems to reward him just the way it is. I mean, it is also important what we said earlier about the aristocracy that he sees himself in. You see, those below him and his peers are losers. But they are not losers simply because they lose. No, they lose because they are losers. You see, at every point of a victory, credit must be given and the cause of his victory must be explained. Now, the ego of a man who is never forced to reflect from suffering has no reason to believe that the credit should go anywhere but themselves and their own greatness. For only in failure will the ego try its best to shift credit onto anything but itself. You know, it is the attitude we can see in Justin Bieber. The man clearly has no meaningful talent, but he is exactly the formula which attracts teenage girls and their money. His success is both the culmination of his own efforts, but mostly by the giant infrastructure of the record label who promotes him. It is the result of countless behind-the-scenes talented people who bring that image to life. His genesis differentiates itself from those who failed only in the aspect that he succeeded. He is a product of luck more than anything else. And though I have no problem with him cashing in on his luck, he does not serve as an exemplar of anything other than luck. There's a tendency for people to seek out genius in all those who succeed. They look for it to justify the failures in others and themselves. But in most, there's no account deeper than luck. A man may work hard digging for gold, but if he, by happenstance, chose the wrong place, his efforts will go unrewarded. But so too, in this way, will the alpha male credit himself for his victories. And since he succeeds because of what he is, those that fail, fail due to what they are. He is a winner, therefore they are losers. The world to him is mostly the way it should be as far as he is concerned, and it is only the fault of the loser for losing. So with this view, too, he is not motivated to question anything about society, and in this way he inadvertently becomes a cheerleader for the status quo. He conforms, and what society says is how it is supposed to be. This is further reinforced by the shame that comes with nonconformity from the status quo. As he is susceptible to shame, he feels the need to conform doubly strong. You see, it is not to the benefit of a woman to only have a dominating man. No, for if this man were to merely protect her, but never give her anything of his, she would be no better off. No, she needs to have a dominating male that gives, a male that will give to her, but not only in times of plenty, but also in times of scarcity. But then, what dominating male would be willing to give his hard-won food during a famine to a woman, considering many women would have him? One who prefers the pangs of hunger to those of shame. And if he is willing to give the greater, he is willing to give the lesser. And in this way, all of his becomes hers. The sensitivity of this man to social norms means that his opinion will be that of the masses. Also, as with all people, he will select like-minded friends, which creates an echo chamber of cultural norms in all his social interactions. He will feel a harsh sting if called gay or unmanly. He will carefully tune his image to reflect as closely as possible the echoes of culture. He will take pride in being disposable at his gynocentric view of women. His peers will pat him on the back for being such. He is the sort of man you can hear uttering phrases like, "Oh, women, you know how they are," and "Women, can't live with them, can't live without them." Being blue pill is the image that puts him furthest away from shame, and so that it is what he will be. So, with this account in place, I think we can now begin to answer the questions we set out to see if we could answer. Is being an alpha male a desirable experience? Is such a man happy? What is the price of being such a man? And most importantly, can a beta become an alpha a beta? And what would that transition look like? But before we answer these questions, let us remember that we are referring to the alpha that is chosen by women, and not one of those, you know, alphas who rule in other domains. We are only now referring to the man who, by virtue of his I can kick your ass appearance, is gravitated towards as most desirable. To the first question, is being an alpha male a desirable experience? I would have to offer a stern no. To be this man is not only to have his success with women, but also to have his mind. You must lack depth so that you can, in your natural state, be on the level of women. To be able to respond effortlessly in the manner expected of you, you must get excited over the banalities of life, value the superficial, and seamlessly mold yourself into the culture. You must be a timely man, a man of the generation you live in, completely devoid of the historical perspective, completely devoid of antagonistic positions. You must appeal to the most base of the species, the natural, the instinctive. And most damning of it all, you must be a hedonist, live only for pleasure. You see, as with most success in anything, so too with the alpha male, we only see what the benefit is, but we hardly give a second thought as to the cost of this benefit. The price of being an alpha male is being an alpha male, and the cost is too high. Is such a man happy, though? You know, he is, in the way an animal is happy. This is the happiness that comes from the ignorance of your own mortality. I mean, there's an ever-present immediacy and grounding to his soul. But his happiness is dated. This question reminds me of the story of Solon the Wise and a wealthy king. So Solon was this wise man from the ancient Greek world. He was one day summoned by a wealthy king to come look upon the king's life. The king showed Solon all his riches and the place he lived, the women he had. And he asked Solon, "Do I not look like a happy man to you?" Well, Solon refused to answer. When pressed by the king, Solon finally said to him, though, "You know, I cannot answer this question while you are still alive, for it will be the net sum of your life that will tell me if you were a happy man or not." And, as fate would have it, not too long after Solon left, this king lost his wealth, his son was killed in a hunting accident, his land was conquered by a neighboring enemy, and the king himself was sentenced to be executed. So in this way, too, the alpha male is like the king. He is happy for a time in his life, but one day, too, the alpha male loses his order of rank, but he keeps on living. We must in this way, too, look upon the entirety of what the alpha male's life entails and judge that life as a whole, and not only on one or two advantages we see him experiencing in his prime. So in a way, the alpha male, too, hits the wall, as it were. His glory is contingent on something unearned, on something given. He is the hot chick of males, but with gynocentrism acting in reverse. Can a beta then become an alpha? Well, this is something partially contingent on your physical stature. If you're short, you'll have a hard time ever generating that intimidating aura, though it is possible. First and foremost, you must sculpt your body to resemble the I can kick your ass aura without crossing too much into the criminal look. You know, a muscle-bound man radiates an aura of strength, but if this is coupled with excessive tattoos, he begins to look like a criminal. After you have sculpted your body, you'll need to focus on becoming banal, common, blue pill. You must learn to love trivialities and abandon any serious development of the mind. Though it is not necessary to become stupid, it is necessary to welcome the idea of living in violation of the principle of non-contradiction. Like women, you must be able to hold in your mind two contradicting beliefs in order to accomplish this. You need to remove yourself from abstraction that would in turn expose you to the reality of living these contradictory beliefs. For example, you must hold the belief that beauty is internal, but choose women based on looks. And this is easy to do with a simple, sophistical trick by asserting that external beauty is merely the physical manifestation of internal beauty. You know, with such a sophistical non sequitur, you can, with a straight face, justify to yourself holding both beliefs. Though your argument is invalid, it sounds valid on the surface, and you should only concern yourself with what is on the surface. Above all, do not pursue philosophy. By pursuing philosophy, you will consciously be aware of your contradictions, and this will manifest itself in your body language in one way or another. No, you need to make yourself shallow, full of soundbite wisdom, and never question the coherence of your belief system. For when you couple your sculpted body with a genuine belief in a script of incoherent nonsense, you will have gained the disposition of the woman you so sought to gain. This in turn will make you unnatural, for you will naturally think as they do. Finally, you must become proud from many victories. This pride will finally close the circle and create a reinforcing cycle in which you will become intolerant of someone trying to demonstrate to you that you're wrong. Your abandonment of philosophy will synergistically let you keep a conscious honesty as to your justification, and your physique will encourage your opponent to subconsciously back down. So, based on the account I have given in this video, this is what would necessarily follow as your task in transforming into an alpha male. Of course, it is not necessary to become this sort of being in order to attract women, but this is what I see as necessary to become this oh-so-prized alpha creature. Thanks for listening. Go team.